The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, this is the first time we are getting to talk without a guest in the beginning of the year. And, you know, there's an awful lot of stuff going on. You know, Drew has been to Europe now twice, and, of course, we had that recording. But why don't you talk a little bit about some of the things that are going on in Europe as far as gold and gold supplies go?
Yeah, I think as we look to 2014 and look back at 2013, there's a couple of things we want to reflect on. One is the tremendous power of Abenomics and sort of the redefining of the Asian market dynamics there. The yen's down 17%. The Nikkei was up. That's their stock market, up 57%. Here in the U.S., one of the defining elements in 2013 was QE, quantitative easing. You had levitation of stock prices in the U.S. and a massaging of that recovery narrative. Moving, you know, back towards Asia, China has really tried to deflate what has become a credit bubble. And we'll talk a little bit about that this morning, too. It really with no success. You had the most recent audit revealing a 70% increase in shadow banking activity. That's loans being made, you know, around the banking system and sidestepping loan limits. Local and municipal debts have ballooned to over $3 trillion. Coming back to the United States, you've got Obamacare and the tax onslaught, which begins this year. Actually, I guess you could say it began last year. And also the gold element, which you mentioned, we've been very active in flying back and forth to Europe. Drew Kroll, who's been with us for 31 years, has been on a plane so many times in the last 3-4 weeks, would make your head spin. In fact, I think his head still is spinning from jet lag. But we were presented with an opportunity by a bank in Europe liquidating literally tons of gold, and it just so happened that there's product in the mix that to the non-discerning eye is just ounces, to the discerning eye is just flat out the best opportunity we've seen in 10 years. So we have been, I mean, again, Drew missed the company Christmas party this year,
right?
And because he was on a plane to Germany. But it's very interesting. The context is creating opportunities. It's also creating pitfalls. And I think that's where, coming into 2014, investors need to be cognizant of both and make sure that they are stepping lightly, but deliberately, very deliberately, wherever they do step.
Well, and so we'll cover all those issues from Abenomics to QE, China, Obamacare, and then we'll finish up with what you were talking about on the gold. But why don't we go ahead and start then with Japan, because it's an amazing experiment in massive money printing, massive money devaluation, with the expectation that Keynesianism would kick in and that corporations would actually raise wages, you know, in light of the yen devaluing. So talk about that a little.
Well, Japanese monetary authorities and politicians, they counted on the corporate sector increasing wages for workers, and that was basically the quid pro quo for devaluing the yen and handing a massive trade advantage to the big manufacturers and exporters.
If the yen is going to buy a certain amount less, then the expectation in Japan is that they're just going to raise the wages.
Well, that's right. On a silver platter, you've got extra profits being handed to corporations, and there really was an expectation that if we're giving you the opportunity to make more money as a corporation, you will compensate your employees with an increase in salaries and income. And that, again, is the quid pro quo. You will then see an increase in consumption and an offset to the devaluation in the yen.
Well, and David, that's not been happening. I mean, the wages don't seem to be going up. The money's coming right out of their pocket, basically, this devaluation.
Right, because the prices of goods and services are rising 5 times faster than wages, that according to Bloomberg. And then, you know, the Japanese Times reported that only 17% of companies are planning to raise wages after April 1st. Mm. So, you know, again, you've got a lot that was expected and is not being delivered. There is a consumption tax which increases in April and is a way of sort of fiscally balancing the monetary largesse, but will be even more ineffective if corporations don't play ball with that increase in compensation.
Yeah, and that seems to be the falling out of Keynesianism in general, David. You know, the people, the powers that be, the academics who are printing the money saying, hey, this is going to be good for everyone, that doesn't necessarily follow good business policy. And, you know, if people are just losing the ability to buy because of the loss of purchasing power of the yen, then it actually turns into a negative for the economy, not a positive.
Well, again, politicians seem to have factored out if you're monetizing assets and printing money and driving up the prices of consumer goods, your wage increase is merely going to make up for loss of purchasing power, as you mentioned. You know, but if you come to think of it, this is really how most Keynesians think. Mm-hmm. If you were to simply hand the money out, you know, sort of the Bernanke helicopter drop, if you were to hand it out, you know, it might go to paying down debt, or it might go into the mattress, so to say, as savings. But by driving up the price of consumer goods, you know, assume that there's a pay increase, which has yet to materialize, you see any increase in compensation going right back into consumption. So every new dollar printed is hopefully creating this necessary recycling of yen, and hopefully that's what starts the engine. Unfortunately, it's not expanded consumption, but it should, in their strange book, show better GDP. I think this is silly and, frankly, quite sick, but this is the conclusion they're driving towards.
Well, and aren't we driving to the same conclusion? Let's talk about quantitative easing here on this continent, okay? And, well, David, let me just put this to bed right now, because people are listening to Bernanke and now Yellen. We'll talk about that in a minute. Lowering or tapering quantitative easing from $85 billion a month to $75 billion a month. But the reality is they can tell you anything they want. I mean, it's averaging $91 billion a month. And right after Bernanke tapered, he printed $54 billion that week. So they can do whatever they want. Now, quantitative easing completely blows out any kind of real price discovery. I mean, the price of anything really gets messed up, doesn't it?
It does. And that's where we're seeing, you know, one of the major themes of 2013, and we get to deal with the ramifications of it this year. You've got price distortions, which really reign supreme. Stocks are bubbling. Real estate, again, back to, in many jurisdictions, back to pre-bust levels. And, you know, we think that stocks particularly are likely to peak in the first quarter of this year or by mid-year. You've got Jeremy Grantham that sees fair value in the stock market 70% lower than current levels.
So real prices should be 70% lower, according to Grantham.
Real value in terms of what he would consider a compelling purchase, 70% lower. You've got Andrew Smithers, who, you know, as we discussed with him on the commentary a month ago, 50 to 75% overvalued now is what he considers the stock market to be here in the U.S. We look at strong corporate balance sheets, and that's a part of the argument for why QE has been successful. It's helped rebuild balance sheets, et cetera, et cetera. Well, corporate balance sheets, frankly, Kevin, if you're looking at the Dow 30, the big companies, if you take their cash and subtract their debt, you find that there's $500 billion that's in the red. They are in debt to the tune of $500 billion, eliminating their cash positions, netting out cash against debt, still have an overhang of $500 billion in debt. That's a lot of leverage.
Well, that's
a lot of leverage on the balance sheet.
It sounds to me like they don't have a positive balance sheet. What you're saying is if you take the debt out, they don't have positive balance sheets, which that would put us in a declining, wouldn't that be a recessionary type of symptom?
Well, I think what we see is that corporations have been inspired or enabled to malinvest, just like we've criticized the Chinese for malinvestment in the past, where, you know, government-funded projects don't always get the same criticism as the private sector might give to them, and that's what we've seen in China. Well, when you drop capital costs to zero, all of a sudden capital starts getting thrown around on a very free basis without a lot of thought, intelligent thought going into it. So we do see actually quite a bit of unhealthy behavior. I'm reminded of Warren Buffett's reflections back in the 1970s that interest rates are the key determiner of stock prices. When rates are coming down, you have fuel for a major bull market and you have tremendous growth prospects. And when rates are on the rise, you have no such fuel, and the bear market is what you can expect. A declining trend is what you can expect in the context of rising rates.
So when we're talking about 2013, I mean, rates are almost at zero right now, Dave, and have been, but they have been rising. That seems to be the trend.
Yeah, you consider the events of 2013 where what I would describe as a bought rate, an out-of-market rate, but something that was manipulated. The 10-year Treasury reached a low of 1.5% and has since doubled to 3%. Yeah, this is, of course, that big increase, a doubling of the rate. That's with the expectation of tapering to a small degree. And what should occur if the Fed gets out of the business of interest rate manipulation, buying more than $1 trillion worth of paper assets a year, is it fair to say rates moving higher? And that goes back to Buffett's notion that you have headwinds to growth when you're in a rising interest rate environment. So it's a catch-22. government would like to move away from a very ineffective stimulus policy, that is quantitative easing, and yet the consequence of moving away from it is the rise in rates, which represents not only headwinds for growth, but definitely a black mark for the U.S. stock market.
Well, and one of the things that's kept interest rates from rising, as you've spoken, is the quantitative easing. I mean, if we don't have to go out and offer competitive interest rates to the world to, you know, basically borrow money, then we buy it ourselves with this quantitative easing. I read something the other day, Dave, that was fascinating, that up until 2008, the Federal Reserve's balance sheet was about $800 billion. So for almost 100 years, the balance sheet, the amount of debt that the Federal Reserve purchased and held, was about $800 billion. At this point, they've been adding $1 trillion a year to that. So they're adding 100 years of debt every year to their balance sheet. They're starting to realize they can't do that forever.
Well, and as we've mentioned, I think in last year's DVD, this notion that $5 trillion is really a critical point where the rest of the world begins to take notice and say, hey, wait a minute. This can't go on forever. And, it, you know, extraordinary measures on a short-term basis, we understand, but addressing structural problems with this sort of baling wire and chewing gum approach, no, this is far too excessive. Kevin, there's a theme in the stock market that I think is worthy of note, going back to some of the considerations of interest rates. As we mentioned before, corporations have engaged in record share buybacks this last year with increased earnings non-organically, again, but by reducing the supply of stock shares outstanding.
Yeah, explain that just a little bit. When you own a corporation or when you own a stock, what you're owning is a percentage of a share of shares. But if the corporation is coming back in and buying those shares up, it's reducing the overall pool. Correct.
Yeah. Well, just, you know, each quarter we hear this report from companies that says that we made X number of dollars per share. So let's say a company makes $100 and they have 100 shares.
Right.
You made a dollar per share. But now all of a sudden, if you shrink the pool, if you shrink the number of shares outstanding to 50,
then it's $2 a share.
You made $2 a share and you've increased your earnings per share from $1 per share to $2 per share. And it looks like your earnings per share growth is off the charts. All you've done is manipulate the one variable there that you're dividing by. So it's an easy way to financially engineer a result that's easy to advertise. The media loves it. The media says, look at the growth we're seeing. Earnings per share beat expectations. It's up, it's up, it's up, it's up. Well, you know, QE sets the environment for this kind of misallocation of capital. You've got cash instruments which yield nothing. And should cash positions grow, you have investors who start complaining about company assets doing nothing. It's just sitting there doing nothing. Why aren't you spending it to grow the business? If you're not going to grow the business, then give it back to us. Then come in your activist investors. These are the folks like Carl Icahn and others who take a major chunk of stock and start insisting on one-time dividends or share buybacks or things like this. And when you look at this year, the impact of these buybacks, nearly 60% of the increase in the S&P 500 earnings is attributable to buybacks.
That's astounding, Dave. What you're saying is 60% of the increase in earnings is actually just this reduction of the size of the share pool by buybacks.
So this is where, you know, we have reason to be concerned about current valuations in the equity markets. When buybacks are such a significant piece, it's not an increase in revenue. Then you have companies like Merck. You've got the drug manufacturer facing competition from generic manufacturers. They're not willing to increase CapEx spending, and so they start, instead of filling the pipeline for tomorrow's products, they increase their share buybacks. I mean, or FedEx. This week, they borrowed $2 billion to buy back stock at an all-time high. And again, this is partially driven by activist investors. I think it's also driven by executives who want to capture a better benefit. They show earnings per share is through the roof.
Well, I would feel like I was brilliant. If I was running a corporation and I doubled the earnings per share, what an amazing thing. Now,
particularly when the compensation is tied to it, which is what Andrew Smithers was getting
at.
He's saying basically we've misaligned corporate and executive pay packages in such a way that they are going to play with the numbers. And if you don't appreciate that the numbers you're looking at have been fudged by corporations all around the world, then you don't understand the game that's being played. And it starts with corporate remuneration or boards that have put remuneration packages together that reward this kind of behavior.
Well, and you mentioned Carl Icahn. Okay, there are large holders of shares that know when to actually sell out. And wouldn't this be an occasion where you've got the large pension funds and the inside kinds of guys saying, hey, I'm going to use this as a way out.
Certainly. When you shrink the number of shares, yes, you may rig financial results and attract Main Street investors because it gives the media something to really trumpet and say, look how well things are going here. And so it does bring sort of the lemming trade into the market. But this is a part of an exit strategy, in our opinion, for large holders of big blocks of stocks to, again, be able to exit the market. And you're able to do that both on the back of Main Street money, which is lured by positive quarterly results, and corporate capital, which has no other better place to go, and so it's being put to, in our opinion, a bad use as share buybacks. Give them the liquidity they need to exit major positions.
Mm. Okay, Dave, but companies can only do this so long. I mean, what happens if buybacks slow down at this point?
What you have is hundreds of billions of dollars this last year, which has goosed the market higher. One of the largest contributing factors to the stock market moving higher has been literally hundreds of billions of dollars worth of share buybacks in the year 2013. And that, again, if you take away the hundreds of billions of dollars worth of buying, where does the market go? Do you have the requisite energy to get stocks higher still? You really hope for that many more lemmings to replace the corporate capital that was spent in share buyback schemes.
Well, and I hate to say it, Dave, but that's usually when the guy who you talk to who says, you know, every time I buy a stock, it goes down. Well, usually they end up buying stocks after the rise, the last 10 or 15% of the rise.
Right. So who are the patsies that buy the last 10% of the move? Yeah, if you look at the top 100 companies out of the S&P 500, which have been buying shares back, the outperformance of those shares since 2009, the lows in 2009, is by 50% compared to the index. You know, so tell me executive bonuses don't factor in. I mean, this is, again, the theme we discussed with Andrew Smithers. If you haven't spent time listening to that discussion, by all means, visit the archives. It's too important. And without those insights, you may conclude in error that the improvement in the stock price that we have had over the last 6, 12, 18 months is an indication of economic recovery. Not so.
Right. Well, speaking of recovery or non-recovery, we have Ben Bernanke now out. Janet Yellen has now been confirmed. Okay. What are we looking for? Everybody was saying she's just going to be a dove and print and print and print.
We're looking for the dawning of the age of Aquarius. That's what we're all looking for. We're looking for world peace. We're looking for our grandma to bake apple pie or cookies when we get home from school with a nice glass of milk. Yellen is confirmed, and actually, in all seriousness, she may surprise us with far more aggressive reduction of QE. You've got the media, which will herald the triumph of central banking, and central planners the world over will be reinvigorated looking at this sort of apparent success story. The further reduction in QE, in our view, is coming from a bubble in the making in the stock market, not as a success story for an economic recovery. We haven't seen that in the jobs market. We certainly haven't seen that on Main Street. We've seen it on Wall Street, and the recovery for the 1% has been very robust, but for the 99, not so much. So again, we've got bubbling activity in the stock market. We've got inflationary expectations, which are now shifting, and we have corporate lending, which is reaching extreme risk levels, where sort of junk is the new black.
And you're talking about junk bonds is the new black.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, everyone used to say,
and junk bonds, by the way.
Well, thank you.
Yeah,
thank you. My portfolio looks very nice with that 7% yield in junk bonds. Everyone has to have it. And this is, I think, what the Fed is actually looking at as opposed to what they're talking about. They talk recovery. What they're actually looking at is, again, stock market moving up and up and up, inflationary expectations beginning to shift, corporate lending at risky levels where even, you know, a junk bond issuance is getting a massive oversubscription. There's too much of a fever pitch, frankly, a little too much going on in the credit markets for us to be comfortable with. The quality, you know, your covenant-lite loans. The percentage of covenant-lite loans, this is like a rehash of 2007, where you don't have to have any money down, you don't have to have any assurances, no skin in the game, there's money available.
This is exactly what created the real estate bubble in the first place.
It's the consequence of easy money. And this is really basic, but QE and the theme which started out in 2013 and is being sold to the general public as our great salvation and the means by which the economy is recovering is, in fact, the very same thing that brought us the collapse in 2001 and the collapse in 2008. Now, you do have just to sort of offset this, you do have the Fed's reverse repo facility, which is gearing up for a drain of liquidity. I think they know they've put too much liquidity into the system. The question is, how do you eliminate it? Can you eliminate it? And you've already got fixed income buyers and money market funds aiding the Fed, again, through their reverse repo facilities.
Okay, well, if interest rates actually do go up, and that's what we're talking about here, when we talk about tapering quantitative easing and we talk about a drain in liquidity, we're talking about interest rates having to rise. Now, how does that affect corporations?
Yeah, well, you've got corporations, $427 billion in corporate financing, which will have to be rolled over. It's coming due in 2014. And that, you know, that means that rates at a very low level would be ideal.
So you'd want to lock it in now if you think rates are going up.
Yeah, absolutely. But the Fed's indicated course is signaling the opposite, that in fact rates are going higher,
right,
and won't be low and may not accommodate a 2014 rollover of $427 billion in corporate bonds. Now, corporations have been very savvy in terms of refinancing their debt. And this is where, again, you look at corporate growth and how their numbers have improved, and you see, going back to Warren Buffett's comment, that interest rates are everything in the stock market, everything in the stock market. How much of corporate growth in recent months has been driven by sales or improved revenues? When you look back to 2000, you've got corporate net profit margins, which are up about 8.3%. You've got total employee expenses, which are down about 8.1%.
Which makes sense, because unemployment has not been solved.
Sure, yeah. But you've, and so the quote-unquote increase in productivity goes in lockstep with an increase in unemployment. Each employee that you retain is that much more productive because they have to do the work of three people.
Right.
So, but this is the point. The net interest expense from the year 2000 to present is down 41.7%. The cost of capital or interest rate trends are the key to equity prices over the next decade. Keep them low and this game might continue. Lose control and it's game over for the equity investor.
Well, and Dave, this may seem like it's from left field, but just statistically, okay, Piper Jaffray's research has shown that midterm election years, the average decline in equities is 17%. And they go back to 1930 with that study. So take all this stuff out of the equation and just say, hey, you know, we're sort of in a midterm election year. The average decline has been 17%. This is a good year for a peak in the stock market, isn't it?
It is. Whether that comes in Q1, Q2, we do think that it comes early and that this is a tough year. An encore to 2013, that's a tough one to pull off.
Well, and one of the bright spots, I guess, growth-wise, this last decade has been China. I mean, everyone has been looking towards China because the growth rate has been spectacular. Now, you've weighed both sides of the equation on China. You're positive in some ways and you're negative in some ways. What's your thought for 2014?
Right. Well, in 2013 highlights, where we were and where we're going in 2014, as you've mentioned, negatives, positives. We look at all of the sides we can and try to figure out what exactly outcomes will be. There are transitions afoot, which, if they're successful, will redefine the global economy with China moving up the ranks. However, this is a big however, the transitions require a political will which may or may not exist. And so if politicians cannot gather the gumption to sacrifice some of the vested interests in the state apparatus, it's not going to happen.
Well, and what we've seen over the last few years in China, a lot of it's government investment in infrastructure, is it not? I mean, that's where the growth came from.
Exactly. The economic gap created by the 2008 crisis was filled by government investment in construction and infrastructure. And this allowed China to show growth figures while the rest of the world was contracting and lacking growth in that 2008-9-10 period. It was and is artificially stimulated growth. Now the question remains, what becomes of all the project financing put in motion in the context of the crisis? You know, just as we had in the West, a credit blowout circa 2006 to 2008 with multiples of official or balance sheet debt. You know, again, there was the official debt everyone knew about. Then there was the non-official debt, off-balance sheet debt, what's known as the shadow banking system, through financially engineered products, which allows for even greater systemic leveraging. Well, so too, China has expanded its official and its non-official debt. As we mentioned earlier, you've got a 70% increase in shadow banking activity, and with loan limits being completely ignored or worked around because of the shadow banking activity, we now find in the most recent audit, local municipal debts ballooning to over $3 trillion. So this, again, is where you weigh positives and negatives. You can see a masterful chess game being played and the right decisions being made on paper. Now, there's always a difference between the ideal plan on paper and how it's implemented. And I think this is, again, going back to that British phrase, many a slip between the cup and the lip. There is many a mistake which can be made from the paper planning process by the Politburo, yeah, I'd say that 10 times, and then the implementation of those policies. We couple this with the rising risk of Japanese confrontation, and really, you know what you have in 2014? You have an echo of 1814. You have an echo of 1914. These time frames where if you looked back, you had only positive prospects, and then things went south very quickly.
Well, I think that's important to point out, because when you look at 1814, I'm thinking especially 1914, Dave. There's a great article in The Economist a couple of issues ago where he was saying, you know, if you were in early 1914, you'd think everything was absolutely perfect. You'd have a globalized world. We had a gold standard at the time. Nations were trading with nations. John Maynard Keynes even wrote a little piece that said, you know, I can sit in bed and use this new item called the telephone and actually order things from all over the world. My gosh, that sounds exactly like now. But there were tensions brewing that could be changed simply by just a couple of alliances breaking down, and it seems that China is starting to beat the war drum.
Well, I think that article in The Economist you mentioned, late December 2013, is a must-read, looking at parallels between 1914 and 2014. Since the 2008 crisis, China has become much more aggressive. After decades of practicing a go-along-to-get-along kind of attitude, and Deng really set that in motion, Deng Xiaoping, where he basically said, you know, listen, we're not going to cause any waves. We're not going to invade Taiwan. That would just create problems for us. We will saber rattle, but that'll be the extent of it. That go along to get along has come to an end as of 2008. You have China reasserting its claim to Indian territory. That's the Arunachal Pradesh region. You've got the declared sole rights to the Senkaku Islands. You've got the unequivocally claimed vast tracts of the South China Sea as Chinese territory. You know, all these things are very bold, and they're outward moves after decades of sort of an internal focus. Let us do our own thing. We're not going to make any waves. And again, that meets with some degree of friction when you have the same sort of nationalist saber-rattling with Japan.
Well, and Dave, we had James Rickards on the program. I'd like to have him again because he talks about how war can be fought with currencies. And, you know, we talk about laying claim to these areas of geography that they say they hold dear, but actually the tensions are building with the currency war that Japan, they threw down last year. When they drove the yen down, they forced another exporter of goods to also have to devalue its currency. And I'm talking about China.
Oh, yeah. Far more important than laying claim to the Senkaku Islands is laying claim to a slice of global GDP that belongs to your neighbor.
Right.
So you add to the geopolitical pressures between China and Japan the steep devaluation of the yen in 2013. That's a 17% drop in the value of the yen. Mm. And you have the makings of a competitive currency war between these two manufacturing and exporting giants. Japan was displaced by China. Think about this sequence. Japan was displaced by China as the second largest economy in the world, and shortly thereafter, the Japanese government begins Abenomics, devaluation with the intent to improve exports at the expense of trade competitors.
Yeah, and that's what Jim Rickards talks about. He said there's no way that you're going to improve one country's exports without taking something away from another country. Okay, speaking of taking away, and this is painful. I hate bringing this concept up. I don't even like seeing it in the paper.
It's like surgery without anesthesia.
Obamacare.
Oh.
Okay, people are calling. They're saying, how's it going to affect me? You know it's a tax increase. I just don't understand all the tax increase.
Well, when in history, in the history of government benefits, have we ended up with anything other than a veiled tax hike? That's every major program. If you go back to the Johnson era, we were talking about, Declan and I were going up to the ski area the other day, and we're talking about LBJ and the Great Society programs and how this is, you know, you promise a little, and all of a sudden that little bit of a promise represents this huge slice of GDP. It's a major part of our economy. And again, it was nothing more than a veiled tax hike.
Hmm.
We've had that over and over and over and over again.
And it's never reduced. I mean, let's face it, they've never shrunk a government program.
No. So you have higher healthcare premiums. That's a given. Then you've got new taxes and fees. Heritage Foundation has reprinted this. Worth going to their website, heritage.org, and looking at the increased costs of Obamacare. This comes from the Joint Committee on Taxation and the Congressional Budget Office, and they highlight 18, to be precise, and this includes, so there's 18 various tax increases and fee increases. You look at it and you just go, oh my word, what have we done to ourselves? Including a 10% excise tax on indoor tanning services.
Oh, right, except for, you know, let's face it, anyone under 18 is not going to actually be partaking.
Well, right, at least in the state of Illinois, you're right, because one of the many new pieces of legislation that's being put in place in 2014 is that in Illinois, minors can no longer go to tanning beds.
So we don't actually always have increased taxes. We also have tax breaks going away. I mean, I know there are a few that are going away this year.
55 so. Tax breaks disappeared December 31st, 2013. Then you've got, well, getting away from Obamacare, but 40,000 new laws which take effect this year. That's state lawmakers that have put 40,000 bills in motion for this year. And I know this is a long way from Obamacare, but it's boggling my mind.
Right.
You get California, which is approving high school students using any bathroom they choose, you know, claiming that gender identity trumps birth identity. Junior high boys,
yeah.
You choose which bathroom you use? This is insanity. Yeah. This is just, frankly, not even common sense. I appreciate being sensitive to everyone and trying to be PC. This is just simply insane.
Well, and Dave, you talk about 40,000 new laws. What it reminds me of is a book that we have on our list of required reading on the website. It's Frederick Bastiat's The Law. And what he talks about is civilizations and societies that move from moral and ethical understanding of the law. They have to have a law for everything. And what he says is you really can look at a society and judge just how free they really are by the thickness of their law book. And unfortunately, 40,000 new laws is showing me that a society's running out of control.
It is running out of control, and it's also being defined by what Bastiat described as legalized plunder.
Hmm.
Legalized plunder. That's probably the most important, in my mind, the most important book in the law is how the law is used, either to protect you or to abuse you.
Right.
And the fact is, the law is not neutral. It can serve the greater good, and it can serve mankind, or it can serve as a baseball bat, and that is what legalized plunder becomes.
Well, and speaking of plunder, this takes us to our point on gold, okay? Things started to change last February when Germany asked for its gold back, okay? They said, you know, go ahead and send a little bit of the, 600 or 700 tons back to us. The United States government came back and they said, well, okay, we'll do that, but it's going to take 7 years. Now, has something been plundered on this side?
Well, that's what's interesting. I think there are high-stakes games being played here, and if people aren't paying attention to the nuances and the themes between the lines, you're missing exactly what is happening in the geopolitical spheres. You had Venezuela and Germany requested ounces to be delivered. I mean, so you can sum up the gold market in 2013 and say it stunk. It stunk. The price went down, but there's really interesting stories in the context. Venezuela and Germany requests the ounces that they've stored in quote-unquote safe locations in the Western world, and very suspicious futures trading begins immediately.
Mm.
And then you've got a market beating in the metal space, which was accompanied by panic selling from investors who are only recently purchased the asset, probably for all the wrong reasons.
Right.
Chasing the price, obviously the price moved up 60%. In 1 year. And just like Bitcoin today, show me a positive rate of return and I'm going to chase it. That's the way most investors behave. What is this about Bitcoin? What, the same attitude was gold fall 2011. Tell me more about gold. Tell me more about gold. I don't know anything about it, but the price is moving up. I got to own some. The general public started to come into gold late in the game. And again, they got their heads handed to them. They came in for the wrong reasons, chasing a price trend and not understanding why you own it from a fundamental standpoint, why you own it as an insurance policy embedded in your total financial picture.
And this isn't new. I mean, games have been played. We've talked about the 1970s.
Yeah, the IMF gold sales, they were announced in the 70s. That was, if you want to call it impact news, it was intended to drive prices lower. That has had a diminishing negative effect then and now. You know, in this year's DVD, we're going to highlight several of the factors impacting gold demand, along with investor demand, consumer demand, and one of the things that we're going to detail is also central bank demand. This is very interesting because we have central bank currency reserves at a new high.
You're talking about currency in the form of fiat currency.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Well, it's easy to increase the currency reserves that you have when you have no limitations in terms of your printing presses. We've gone from $1.6 trillion, according to the IMF, in 1999. That was total global central bank currency reserves. $1.6 trillion, 1999. Now, we reached a new high, $11.4 trillion.
unbelievable. So for hundreds of years, they built up to $1.6 trillion. And then in 13 years, we're up, you know.
Sevenfold. So the U.S. dollar now accounts for 61.4% of all currency reserves. That's down from 65%, what it was at the peak of the crisis in 2008. You've got expanded holdings of the euro. You've got smaller holdings of the Aussie dollar, the Canadian dollar, the British pound, Swiss franc, etc. Just something I want people to know. UC Berkeley is hosting a gathering for young central bankers here in the next couple of months from around the world. It's co-sponsored by the World Gold Council to discuss how to incorporate gold into the mix of reserve assets.
Isn't that interesting? Yep. We're starting to see the soundings of a return to a gold standard, per se.
Well, I would say not a gold standard, at least if Barry Eichengreen is giving the presentations, because he hates the gold standard with a passion.
Well, you've talked to him about it on this program.
And yep. He's the professor, and I guarantee you he's one of the main presenters at the... He's a professor at UC Berkeley.
Right.
So he has to be a part of this conversation.
Right.
Yeah, so UC Berkeley is hosting it. The World Gold Council is a part of it. Really, what you're looking at is long-retired central bankers, again, coming from the Bretton Woods era, 1944 to 1971, they understood the centrality of gold.
Mm-hmm.
But since 1971, bankers have lost touch with gold as a primary reserve asset. And you can see that as it's reflected by the very, very low percentage allocations to gold amongst your developing markets, your emerging markets, as they call them. The legacy holdings that we have in the West, this is stuff we've owned. Europe and America, it's not like Italy's been out buying gold in the last 10, 20 years. This is the stuff that they were able to acquire before or immediately after World War II. Same with American gold. Our 8,000 tons, plus minus, was product that we owned, again, World War II. We actually owned quite a bit more than that, and that's why we closed the gold window in 71, because we saw it rapidly going in the direction of Europe. So, you know, we have this coaching, which is now available for these freshman central bankers as to how to manage gold as a reserve asset. And the only downer, as I mentioned, is that the short course is going to be partially presented by Barry Eichengreen, who no doubt has done more to shape the Wall Street view of gold as a waste of time than anyone else I know. At best, the gold exchange standard is what Barry will present as the most reasonable approach.
Which isn't really a true gold standard. That's what we went to in the 1920s, right?
That's right. The yeah. Council of Genoa in 1922, we came off of the gold standard and went to the gold exchange standard, and what they were basically able to do is say, listen, we'll have some gold in the mix, yeah, but for the ease of convenience, the sake of convenience and safety, transport costs, all of the rest, when you put that whole ball of wax together, we want paper assets as reserves alongside gold. So the main fudge factor in 1922, Council of Genoa, was that they introduced paper into the gold equation. Now they're moving backwards towards gold because I think they're dealing with a paper equation which is, as we speak, being discredited. We have a growing sense of dread as it relates to currency devaluation. All central bankers can look and say, gosh, what happened to the Turkish lira this year? Down catastrophically. What happened to the yen this year? Down catastrophically. What's happened to the dollar over the last 10 years? Down catastrophically. These trends inspire a return to something solid, but no one really has the intellectual framework anymore for understanding how gold fits into the picture.
Well, and let's look at central bank activity just over the last 16 years, because we've talked about this with what's going on with Drew going back and forth to Europe. Okay, the Bank of England back in the late 1990s, horrible timing on their part, great timing on ours. We were able to accumulate a large amount of small gold coins that had been put in reserves maybe 50, 70 years before. The Bank of England then, they were almost out of gold, but the other central banks, they've been net accumulators of gold. So we've been in competition now with the central banks. They're buying gold. China's buying gold. Russia's buying gold. So what makes this unique, Dave, is you've now got a commercial bank. We can't name the country. We can't name the bank, but they're actually divesting of several $100 million worth of gold, and we're taking advantage of the stuff that hasn't been seen. It hasn't seen light in over 50 years.
Well, I love this because, you know, again, we've been operating in Europe for many years now. ICA Europe is one of our companies over in Brussels, and it's put us in a position to be able to look at product which comes available on short notice. This was something where literally our coin buyer, we were getting ready for a black tie event, our normal company Christmas party, and we get a call from Germany And they say, if you want it, you got to look at it. We've already sold the first tranche to Russia.
And we lost our poet. The poet laureate of the company, which we only hear a poem each year at the Christmas party, is Drew Kroll, our numismatist. And he was gone.
He
had to go to Europe.
Well, so we have been very active in Europe buying from this commercial bank. I think it's ironic. I think it's absolutely ironic because this is a bank that used these as reserve assets. They used them as reserve assets, but what they use them for was for them a compelling part of what their total business plan was. We were going to have it as a reserve asset, but we're going to lease it out and collect an income stream from it.
Right.
Well, compliments of the ECB and compliments of Ben Bernanke, compliments of the world central bankers, rates, both lease rates for gold and interest rates across the board have been pushed so low that their primary justification for having gold as a reserve asset for a commercial bank,
which was interest,
earning interest,
yeah,
on loaned out product, just went away. So they decided, we're done with it. Get rid of it. Let's move to paper. We can get rid of the ounces. And literally, we've moved from one man's trash is another man's treasure. And we've found, again, product that's 100, 150 years old, and it's in original mint condition. We're pretty excited about it.
Well, and as we talked about before, you can listen to Drew's interview. It's about a 20-minute interview. Just click on the link that we have on the main page here for this particular program today.
Yeah, it's just, you know, I think it comes at a compelling time because we've got prices. Let's take worst-case, best-case scenarios. Worst-case scenario, let's say we've got gold that goes to $1,000. You've got 20% downside. Best case scenario, you've got a 400% return ahead of you. And I think this is exactly where we were circa 1999, 1998, when we saw similar product, found similar product in Europe, placed similar product with our clients, and anyone who bought that product from us in 1998, 1999.
They're still quadruple, even with the drop,
yeah,
this year.
Yeah. So I am just smiling from ear to ear, looking at this and saying, this sounds so much like history. This sounds like a repeat of where we were 10, 12, 13 years ago. Providence that we were able to find the product, and I think the pricing structure in the market is brilliant. We assumed that we would have to pay huge premiums to buy this product because that would be the only thing that would get it out of the hands of this commercial entity. We've known about this deal for a long time. We just thought they would be selling it for other reasons. We didn't think they'd be scuttling it, asking for virtually no premium for the product. That was the coup, as far as we were concerned, is they fell prey to Société Générale. They fell prey to Goldman Sachs. They fell prey to all of the gold reports that have come out and said, nope, it's a ridiculous relic of the past. You don't need it. Nobody wants it. Can't earn anything on it. Might as well get rid of it before it goes to zero. That's the attitude that's out there. And we'll take the other side of that bet.
Okay, so Dave, we're not making price predictions here on gold. We're just saying it's better than the dollar. And at this point, this may look like what we've seen in the past before a large move. So
I would suggest that when you look at 2014, you have to keep in mind the unintended consequences of Abenomics, the unintended consequences of quantitative easing here in the United States, the unintended consequences of China trying and unable to deflate their credit bubble, the unintended consequences of Obamacare. And I think this is an era where, yes, you want to make sure you have adequate insurance, not too much, but certainly not too little, in the insurance category, what we consider precious metals. Right here, right now, 2014 is the year of unintended consequences.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.